Okay, so let me get started since there's a big hook that'll grab me if I go over time. How did Wesley engage with the science of his day? That's the question. A definitive answer to this question is not yet possible because scholarship in the initial decades of the 21st century in this niche of Wesley studies is just now unfolding with some new perspectives, including a project at the Center for Studies in the Wesleyan Tradition at Duke University under the direction of Dr. Randy Maddox. We can, however, make a few observations that help to put Wesley into proper socio-historical context. Starting with Wesley's heartwarming experience at Aldersgate in 1738, we realize immediately that during the last 50 years of Wesley's life, when he reached the pinnacle of his preaching and organizing success, Wesley was living through what we now identify as the Enlightenment in England, which coincided with the advent of the so-called Industrial Revolution. Wesley's primary concern was always the common man and the newly displaced working class folks who were migrating to the cities and struggling to eke out a living. That being said, Wesley, who was fluent in Latin and Greek, immersed himself in the study of the Eastern Church Fathers and paid keen attention to the writings which circulated from the members of Britain's Royal Society. By 1755, Wesley was compiling essays and articles from the most eminent natural philosophers, quote unquote, natural philosophers of his day. By 1763, he had enough material to publish a two-volume edition called A Survey of God's Wisdom, A Survey of the Wisdom of God in Creation, or a Compendium of Natural Philosophy, which he insisted that his preachers read with some familiarity. By its third edition in 1777, this survey had grown to five volumes. So you can just imagine what a strain that might have put on the saddlebags and the horses of Wesley's itinerant preachers if they had to haul around these volumes. Wesley had also written and published in 1760 an account of his own investigations in the workings of electricity called The Desideratum, or Electricity Made Plain and Useful, which appears to have come to the attention of Benjamin Franklin, among others. Beginning in 1781, when he began publishing his monthly magazine for the literate masses called The Arminian, he frequently serialized longer sections from his survey, as well as the Desideratum, and often reprinted articles on scientific subjects from the Royal Society and other sources. This clearly seems to qualify Wesley as a precursor for engaging in a dialogue with science, although it is always well to remember several key points. One, Wesley first and foremost was a preacher who valued piety and works of charity as the preeminent marks of the Christian faith. Two, the science that we know in our day was hardly a mature field for settled discipline in Wesley's time. Newton's laws had yet to be definitively and universally confirmed. Three, although Wesley championed reason as a legitimate route for understanding and describing the natural world, when the discussion turned to cause, the final arbiter for Wesley was always God. Four, although Wesley reprinted vast sections of material in his survey and in the Arminian magazine, he edited out the more strident sections of those scientists who were beginning to make ontological claims based on their reductionist experiments. And in his own commentaries, he exhibited what we can identify as a modest theology that recognizes the limits as to what we as humans can know for certain. And five, in contrast to those like Francis Bacon, who call for man to reclaim the mastery of the fallen creation, Wesley pleaded for resuming a loving stewardship with the natural world, appropriate to the realization that we have an integral connection to it all. Now, let me briefly summarize the temporal and the social context in which Wesley lived and worked. You might recall that John Wesley was born in 1703, which means that Isaac Newton was his older contemporary. Newton dies in 1743, and there is no evidence that Wesley ever had any contact or correspondence with this great genius of his age. But even though some of Newton's ideas were still being debated and awaiting scientific confirmation, by Wesley's time, the heliocentric perception of the universe was well accepted. And throughout the 18th century, in which Wesley's life extended until 1791, the English poets were celebrating what we might call the physico-theological viewpoint, the use of scientific discoveries to show the wisdom of God revealed in nature. In the words of one poet, Moses Brown, we read this verse: "If lesser proofs such demonstrations show, what may the measured universe bestow? Think, could blind chance, dead in uninvited name, produce such order, so complete a frame?" This point of view was picked up by many prose writings and played an important part in the accepted theology of 18th century England. In France, matters had taken a different turn. Followers of René Descartes, looking at the orderliness of nature, tended to minimize God's hand in a system that was seen to work quite well in and of itself. That movement led to the publication of the famous Encyclopédie in 1777 under the direction of Denis Diderot, the first comprehensive scientific work of the day, sufficiently tainted with atheism to be subjected to Jesuit censorship and royal repression. This continued the tradition of Benedict Spinoza, who in the early 17th century had written Of Miracles, which was part of his larger theological-political treatises. Spinoza had written that nature cannot be contravened, but she preserves a fixed and immutable order. Therefore, miracles in the sense of events contrary to the laws of nature, so far from demonstrating the existence of God, would, on the contrary, lead us to doubt it. That was the context in France. Parallel to all this were stirrings among the philosophers of the church who had begun to rethink many of the assumptions that undergirded the thought of the writers of the Bible, especially the New Testament. Of course, you know that much of the philosophy of the early New Testament period was inherited by the Greeks, from the Greeks, to whom St. Paul was intent on spreading the gospel. And he did so by adapting his message to the categories of thinking that predominated in all the Greek cities that he visited, Athens, Corinth, Thessalonica, and all the rest. As a consequence, the cosmic worldview that dominates the New Testament is as much a Neoplatonist view as it is Hebrew. And one of the basic principles in Neoplatonism is that the order of the universe mediates a singular God down through the hierarchical ranks of a singular cosmos. This allows the cosmos to be mapped into a Neoplatonic chain of being in which physical positions among all the entities is thought to coincide with spiritual rank. All this is background to show the context of natural philosophy into which John Wesley was born in 1703, and that prevailed when he studied with his brother Charles at Oxford in the 1720s. John Wesley had his famous heartwarming experience in 1738 while listening to a reading of Martin Luther's Introduction to the Book of Romans at Aldersgate Chapel. And over the next decade, he became the most widely influential preacher in the British Isles. In the years 1750 to 1800, Wesley was a man who aspired to understanding this burgeoning field of natural philosophy. And he wanted to promote the best scientific thinking of his day when he began his compilation of the writings of the natural philosophers in his time. So he did two things. In 1755, he began to construct a compendium of the best scientific writings of his day, everything from letters to and from members of the Royal Society to articles and excerpts from books being published on everything from human anatomy to astronomy and cosmology. And why did he do this? We really can't say for sure. Maybe Wesley would argue that the more educated and the population can become, the more they would be equipped to make wise decisions in the community and in their own lives. And then the second thing that Wesley initiated, which is significant, is the publication of one of the most widely read monthly magazines in England called the Arminian Magazine. That was initiated in 1778 and ran for 20 years. So how do we begin to decipher Wesley's approach to the science of his day? I believe the easiest way is to summarize this from the way he divided his volumes in the Wisdom of God in Creation. It was divided into five sections. The first part was of man. When I went into this survey, I was pleased to see that Wesley did not start with God or God's wisdom. To me, this signifies Wesley is going to take an inductive approach to his entire subject. In other words, Wesley will be making a bottom-up argument, an approach that itself is familiar to and necessary in science, rather than a top-down approach that posits revelation as the ground of all knowledge. Moreover, Wesley always eschews overstatements about what is being described in the articles and arguments he presents. In several places, he makes reference to authors who draw conclusions that are not borne out by the, quote, facts on the ground, unquote. And he says outright that this is what he's doing, that he's editing these authors. He only quotes papers and articles from authors who are backing up their arguments with objective observations and sometimes experimentation. And finally, in many places, after a long descriptive treatise, Wesley will say to the effect, quote, "This is amazing what we have learned on this matter, and is wondrous how the body works, but as to why God has made it so, we cannot say," unquote. Or he will say, quote, "This is all we know, and we are not meant to know more as to why it is so," unquote. One finds this consistently in many places in this five-volume work and in the Arminian Magazine. The second thing about this first part called Of Man is human origins. What is particularly fascinating, Wesley was living and writing exactly 100 years prior to Darwin's publication on the Origin of Species in 1859. And listen to some of this directly from Wesley. This is from the Survey of God's Wisdom. After 60 pages of description of bodily functions, Wesley says, quote, "There are parts of this wonderful machine the body is composed of in which we and which we derive from our simple primary elementary substances, co-mixed and wrought together with such wonderful precision in such diverse ratios as to produce all that variety that we observe in nature. And what is truly admirable, that some particles which enter into the composition of the body serve but a transient purpose, in which they perform a certain routine of service in the system, which being completed, they become exhausted and redundant, and are finally evacuated as dead and unqualified for further utility to make room for fresh supply, which brings new life and sustenance, and which are soon to be experience the same destiny as their precursors. Thus, all matter moves in a constant reverberation. And it may truly be said that the matter which clothes the present body also clothes the bodies of our ancestors some thousand years ago and will continue its successive alterations as long as the world will endure, unquote. I mean, that sounds to me like Wesley would have quoted extensively Darwin's groundbreaking work later. I think he would have excerpted some of Darwin's work in the Arminian magazine. So, I thought I had 20 minutes.
You have two more minutes. You started at 15 after.
Okay. So the second part is called Of Brutes, and that's where Wesley compares the human body with the bodies of other animals and makes the difference, but he says there's not much difference to distinguish them. Okay, so the third part is called Of Plants, Vegetables, and Economy. And here he surveys any number of plants that are common to Europe, but also being discovered around the world. The fourth section is called Of Earth, Water, Fire, and Meteors. This is really interesting because it's a treatise on the cosmology of his day. And then the fifth section is of the system of the world, where he talks about the Copernican system. So let me conclude without any further detail with this observation. Wesley is known throughout Methodism and the Wesleyan tradition as a great preacher. We've all been instructed about his habits and his endless travels and his preaching to thousands in the fields and the byways of 18th century England. But this is often so emphasized to the extent that he was also a teacher. He was a product of the Oxford education that itself was a product of the Enlightenment. And he soon reached full flower with thinkers like David Hume and John Locke. Both the Wesleyan brothers were fluent in Latin and Greek, and so they were able to communicate with scientists in the British Academy. What is refreshing to me is to see how Wesley reflected a Socratic awareness of the limitations to his knowledge while maintaining a curiosity about all these fields of study. Thus, in his Arminian magazine and in the survey of the wisdom of God in creation, one finds some emerging knowledge of social anthropology, mathematics, paleontology, and even planetary physics. More generally, Wesley's interest showed him trying to keep abreast of contemporary philosophy and of social problems, moral, ethical, physiological, and educational, all questions being raised by the new scientific developments of the 18th century. Universal knowledge seemed to intrigue Wesley as an ideal, even though he seemed aware that as the world and universe expands our knowledge, we are moving further away from attaining certainty. To be sure, Wesley often will close his treatment of any subject with words such as, quote, understanding this in the natural world signifies God's wisdom in creation, unquote. That is his concluding interpretation of what we are learning from the natural world, and is in fact clearly an interpretation that the reader can accept or reject. One of his normal kinds of conclusions is, quote, I trust my heart will always say, both to God and man, what I know not, teach thou me, unquote. So, do you want?
Thank you. Clearly there's a richness there in Wesley that, can continue to be mined. Any questions for me?
I love the point that you made, where he said, we know as much as God has chosen to reveal to us.
So?
We know as much as, that's my paraphrase of what you say, Wesley.
Okay.
The question I would have is it any different now? I mean, the level of science that we enjoy now is higher than what they had in 1755, but it hasn't changed at all in the sense that we can't encompass all that God has created, nor all that God did to create this world. We can only know parts of it. So how are we any different at all than what Wesley talked about in 1755?
Yeah, the first thing, of course, is that the basic affirmation is that science is important, and for allowing us to know what we do know about the natural world. And the second is that there's the same point that Dr. Royal just made in her lecture, is that that science and religion are compatible when properly understood. Go ahead.
I have a quick question. So if we'd like to get your full text, if we email you, can we get it? Would you email us a copy?
Oh, sure. Okay. So who has the emails? Is that?
Well, I think you're in the directory
list.
Okay. Yeah. So you can ask me, and I'll give you the email. Sure. I have to leave out all the references, the direct references, but okay.
That's the time we have available for Maynard. We now give time for people to move to another location if you want to take your time. Otherwise, we'll now transition the microphone between speakers.